In what way can I persuade you to do some change in your life and to go and find something that you lost or deny or abandoned or didn't take care of enough?
Thank you for joining us, BT. We are very lucky to be here on the Shalom Hartman campus, together with the wonderful scholars. We already chatted with a few of your very fine colleagues and friends, and we hope to have an open conversation, see where it goes. We'll go through the history and the mysteries of Jewish mysticism, see what they mean to yourself, a scholar in the field, and to everyday, ordinary people like myself. And hopefully it'll be a fun and exciting conversation. So, Biti, you've done work both on Rabbi Nachman of Breslov and on the Tikkuni Zohar. Those are, if I can say, some of the like the two main poles of your scholarship. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I'm also interested in Kabbalah in Tzfat in the 16th century, in, you know, in Agon Vilna, in Rav Kook, but yeah, yes, we can say so, yeah.
So a lot of diverse but related thinkers and trains of thought. I'm curious, and I'm wondering if you have some insight on this. Rabbi Nachman ben Feige is having a real revival today in Israel, here and around the world, in a new sense of Jewish spirituality and meaning. And I'm always curious to see when things are working spiritually. What is it that's making them tick? And I was wondering if you, as a scholar of Rabbi Nachman, had an insight into what it is in his Torah and his teaching that is really resonating with the public today in 2022, some 150, 200 years since his passing.
Even more, yeah. More than 200. You know, in Israel, it's a big thing. Breslov is a very big thing. First of all, it's the biggest movement of people coming to religion, Chazara B'Tshuva. And it's very interesting because usually Hasidism is very closed communities. And for Breslov, everyone is welcome. Secondly, it's we can see it in books, in theater, in songs, in Israeli songs, you know, that you can take a piece of a Nachman text and make it into a tune, and people are singing it on a radio, and film and movies.
And it's really permeating the culture.
It's very present in the Israeli, space. And also in religious places, you know, it comes up that people are making chavruta on Rav Nachman, sitting and studying the main book of Likutei Moharan. And I can say that Breslov is all over, the Israeli, Israeli chavaya, you know, the Israeli
experience.
Yeah, it's very strong. So, you know, even though it's strong outside, each of us made his own way into Breslov. I can say that I was shocked by the stories first when I read it, and then for the Torot, which is actually homilies that Rav Nachman is writing. And I think that he is the one, like, you know, Watson and Sherlock Holmes. So Sherlock Holmes is saying, you know, in a few kilometers from here, there will be a Niagara Falls. And Watson said, how do you know that? And he said, I can feel in the air, there's a few drops of water coming. So I think Rav Nachman was a kind of a person that saw where Jewish life is going to be. Like, what is going to be? Everything is going to collapse. I mean, the traditional ghetto, strong, close communities of religion will collapse. And he actually, in his life, saw the beginning of it. Enlightenment will come, secularism will come, and there was no way that Jewish style, lifestyle will remain as it is. So I think he actually put in words something that he felt deep inside, that something is going to change and irreversible. It wouldn't be the same as it was. And I think he actually offers us a way of emunah, faith, and religious life that is very interwove into the doubt and to uncertainty and to the fact that he actually acknowledged that science and rational thinking is not the way you can deal with faith. Mm. He said, you cannot, you know, smell a flower with your ear. It's not the right way. It's not the right tool to get into faith. That faith needs a new nisuach, a new expression in nowadays. Pulling it aside from science, pulling it aside from rational thinking, from also Jewish philosophers like Maimonides, for example, that he was against.
There was no love lost between them.
No, not really, not really. Even though he read everything, right. But he realized that to say that faith is something that you need to know and you need to acknowledge in your understanding and your cognitive tools, it's not the right way, and that actually. Faith is not a static thing, but rather a process that actually offers you, demands from you, work, ongoing work, a process, a life process, and that faith is coming with doubt. Mm. And that, as we say, the empty, the void space from God actually has, in a certain way, God's within it. And that Moses, which is the ideal man, actually a very well-known text of Breslov is saying that, taking the verse that, you know, in the biggest revelation description in the Bible of you know, the Jewish people getting to know God and getting the Torah, was a scene that actually was including in itself, inside, a foggy element. Mm. And it says that actually the people of Israel said to Moses, we are going to step back, we can't deal with it. And actually the verse is saying that Moses approached the fog because there was God. Mm. So, you know, in the first level we can say that the mountain, the Sinai mountain, was full of foggy, and therefore Moshe entered the fog. It's a geographical description. But Rabbi Nachman is saying, no, this is actually existential archetype of religious experience, which is, there is a fog, there is uncertainty, there is a vague place, and you need to deal with it. You need to go inside the foggy and to create yourself the experience of God.
You've opened up a whole can of themes here, and I want to take some time to like slowly unpack them one by one, if you'll allow me. So you're saying that Rabbi Nachman is very much on the collective mind and heart of the Jewish people globally, and particularly here in Israel. And you're saying that something has to do with his foreseeing the collapse of faith in the traditional sense, and his reinterpretation of faith as a new model, as a way of life, as a struggling with doubt, against the position of like a Maimonidean or, you know, Aristotelian, like firm, like we know these things because they're true. I'm curious, I want to open up that theme, but I'm curious, I heard you mention briefly about your own journey into Rabbi Nachman as a thinker and as a religious guide, perhaps. I'm curious to know a bit about, as much as you feel comfortable sharing, about your own story into Rabbi Nachman, into the Likutei Maharan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I grew up in a family that actually both of my parents made opposites way. My father started in a secular family and became Chozer B'Tshuva and became into religious in his 20th. And my mom did the opposite direction. She started from a very religious family and she did the other direction. Both of my parents were a part of a group of people, that Rabbi Steinsaltz, the very famous one that created the, you know, the new Talmud setting, that was since then translated into many, many languages. They created
Rabbi
a group
Adin
of
Steinsaltz.
People. Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, yeah. They created a kind of a group of people, a very intellectual, academic, science people, art, therapy, people that wanted to explore their life, and they were meeting a few times a week, I mean studying Talmud, but then also every week, Saturday night, they were meeting this group of people and studying together, speaking about life and studying together. Usually it was Hasidut or something that has to do. I was very little and I was, you know, sleeping in my bed, mm-hmm. but I keep remembering the sounds of the people.
These meetings were happening in your house?
Sometimes they were, you know,
rotating
gotcha. In a people's house, but just to know that people decided not to go to a film or something, right. or just to meet and to study something, made me understand that there's something very beautiful and rich.
So they were exploring these sort of existential themes and questions through the text of Judaism.
Yeah, they were talking about it in a very critical way. Mm-hmm. Not that, you know, Rabbi Adin Steinitz was Adin, and there were a group of people that they were exploring their way into Jewish life in a very critical and sincere, I would say, and profound way. And I thought to myself, wow, it must be very interesting. So I think it really, it made my way. And from the other side, you know, my mom kept challenging me. She's she was a very well-known psychoanalyst in Jerusalem and also New York, but she kept challenging me about, you know, this kind of Freudian critical thinking about religion. Do you need, do you need a figure of a father that will tell you what to do? Right. This kind of things, or everything is sublimation of sex. And there was a lot of challenging around the topic of religion in my home. And I think it really challenged me and created a lot of interest and curiosity about those things. So,
well, fascinating. So you're saying you fell asleep many nights to this critical discussion of Jewish themes, religious themes, and that your mother, who herself came from a religious background, didn't let you accept religiosity as a naive belief, but would challenge you with Freud and with God knows what.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. I'm just curious, did you have a personal relationship with Rav Steinsaltz as you matured?
Yeah, I did, yes. We grew up together, so I was like, it was a group. Actually, they decided about creating a kind of settlement. Mm. Very interestingly, they called it Shalhevet, which is a flame. It's a kind of their understanding of Jewish life as something that needs to be fire in your heart and not something that is has to do with the bourgeois way of living, or I would say, you know, this kind of obeying rules, but rather something that you say fire you, madlikutcha, something that is meaning in a very deep sense to it.
And so they wanted to make an actual lived community that was
they were thinking about it, but because they were all everyone was busy with his own career. Right. And they weren't such, I would say, you know, very practical people. It fell down, but they really wanted to create a kind of they wanted also to influence the society in Israel and to create a kind of a sincere talking about Jewish ideas. I think Rabbi Steinsaltz made his, like, you know, tons of books in a very, I would say, accessible way to people around the world. But every one of this group contribute to this kind of idea. You know, to wake up in a Shabbat afternoon, Saturday afternoon, it's a holy day, and to see my dad sitting and studying and this kind of eating together in meals and singing a Kabbalist song of Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and talking about those ideas, created, I would say, who I am. Yeah,
fascinating.
I think it was also very, very part of it that you should live it. Meaning, I would say, in the Hasidic way, that God is not transcendent to the world, that God is actually within everything you do, with the way you talk to your kids, with the way you create the society around you, with art, with the body. Nothing is alienating you from God.
Right, life, nothing alienates you from God. Everything is part of that.
As everything is right. part of that, right. everything.
And these are values that you carried into your own family, into your own home.
Yeah, I'm trying. You're trying.
Okay, so let's come back to the character that we started with. What was Rabbi Nachman's place at that table of critical Jewish existential Steinsaltzian discourse?
I don't know about Breslov in that days. I mean, I'm speaking about my parents' days. I think Chabad was very on the table, but also Baal Shem Tov. Personally, Breslov, I felt that it's resonates to things that I was thinking about, that faith is not something that you can actually explain. You know, the Hasidic text is saying that it's like a taste in your mouth. Mm. You know, the word ta'am in Hebrew has double meaning. It's also a reason, but it's also a taste. Mm. So there's a pasuk in Psalm, ta'amu u'ru'u ki tov Hashem, taste and see that God is great. But the Hasidic text saying taste in your mouth, you cannot express to your fellow. It's something that is always private. I mean, not the Jewish life is private. It's very public. You go three times a day and you are in a community, but rather it always go through you. It's a personal experience and transformation. That even though it happens outside, maybe if it doesn't touch you, it doesn't touch you. Mm. So it also needs to be by yourself. And I think Rav Nachman is somebody like this. First of all, exposing all his way, coming to be Rav Nachman, you know, writing a kind of a biography, a very, how do you say, chosvani, exposed biography. Not very flattering, I must say, to a rabbi, you know, in his saying that he had a kind of a crave for food and sex and lots of failure and feeling that God is far away from him. All this kind of creating a kind of I would say negative CV, you know, just saying I'm in a process. I'm doing a process that. Being in contact with God, it's not a decision that you make. You made a V. Yeah, I know God exists, and therefore, but it's a kind of a ongoing process that you grow with it and you transfer yourself with it. And this is transformation makes you. It's a kind of an ongoing process. And Rav Nachman actually saying, I wouldn't want myself if I would find myself today in the stage that I was yesterday. So to say, it's a kind of trying to uplift yourself and to improve yourself and to tune yourself. I think made a very impact on me. Not to say that, you know, faith is a kind of a truth or false decision, but rather an ongoing, and that you're very present in it. You need to make your way. You create it actually.
So we have this character that you're opening up, you're fleshing out for us, you're bringing him to life, of a very vulnerable, a very honest, someone struggling with their own challenges, their own doubt, their own temptation as a religious character. Something perhaps, I don't know if we're allowed to make comparisons, but something like Augustine in his Confessions, writing about his own, and really pushing for a first-hand experiential relationship with God. Something like the Muslims might call, I think it's dawk, which is like to taste God, ta'am u'ru'u ki tov Hashem, as King David writes. How does Rabbi Nachman guide or teach his reader to come and taste God? What is the methodology? What is the path to tasting God?
Very interesting question. I would say that, you know, first of all, to say, he's saying to his disciples, I will lead you to a new path. Although it's a very old one, no one stepped on it. So it's a kind of, as my teacher, Professor Yehuda Libes, described it once, it's a kind of a reform, not reform into, you know, it's a reform to say, you know, I will lead you to a new way, to a new path. It's anti-traditional in its essence, but nevertheless to say, I'm bringing you to a new place. or saying about himself, I'm so young, but rather I'm so old. And I'm a chidush. I'm an innovation. I think it's a kind of a guiding line to his disciples and to us to say, you need all the time to come up with a new thing, with a chidush. It's like, you know, it's
an
like
innovation.
Innovation way to think about yourself, to create yourself way of God. Another thing is
to not allow our religious lives to remain static.
You cannot be satisfied
with the status quo.
Right, you cannot remain static. Another way is involving the body. Mm. I think he creates a very psychophysic way of thinking about religion as something that involves the body. For example, if you have a kushiya, if you have a doubt, a question about God, you should scream. He creates a new ritual in the Jewish tradition to go outside to the field and to daven, to leave the prayer house, the shul, and to go to the woods. We can imagine it in Ukraine in his time, in the 18th century, but also for today. I mean, we sitting now in Jerusalem, you know, not far away from here, and there is a wood. Yar Yerushalayim, the Jerusalem forest. There's not a lot of woods in Israel, but people are going there. We can go there now and see that people actually attached, you know, chairs to the trunk of the tree for their coming in the night and screaming, and as Rabbi Nachman puts it, speaking to God as one speaks to his friend. There's a woods for women and for men. I mean, this kind of ritual to say you should relate to God not as a transcendent and not to just somebody is above you and not just as a king and not just as a ruler, but also to create a kind of mutual space for you to be with God. I think it's also a kind of a learning process. And of course, not to be a bourgeois Jew. This is what he said, you know. He said to be a good in need, Jewish people, I know this is not what I wanted from you, he says to his disciples. I want you to be like animals that roar in the woods for God's, you know, will presence or So this kind of not feeling comfortable in your religion area, but trying to use this space as a space for you to make yourself better, to make yourself higher, to make yourself. This is kind of a place that I actually identify that. That religion is coming to your life. It's a part of you. And, you know, as one of the Hasidic of Rabbi Nachman said, God, where is God? God is where you let him in. Mm. So we need to let God in many, many realms of our place. And I think also in a Hasidic way, involving also physical things like dancing, clapping hands, shouting that I mentioned. Mm. It has this kind of understanding that Rabbi Nachman described it in his own style of writing, that not just the soul telling the body, but also the body can tell the soul, meaning the situation that you in your five senses, maybe more, and your body, and your performance are actually creating now a kind of a spiritual moment, and that it's not, they are not alienate to each other, not the body to the soul, not the soul to the body. It's not that if you cut yourself from your body, from your desires, from your sense of beauty, from your materialistic side, you will be higher in the air. No, vice versa. You should actually give a place to the soul to tell the body, and also involve the body in telling the soul all kinds of things. So if you are praying, try to pray in your body. Mm. Try to be active. Try to be, you know, presence in senses, in the musical, in the in your dancing, in your clapping hands. Actually, you know, Professor Chaviva Pedaya, that she's a scholar also, she spoke about two ways of Hasidism. One is the introvert, you know, taking from sociology, one is the introvert and one is the extrovert. So the introvert actually saying we are worshiping God with silence, with nullifying our body and our presence and our ego and everything in order to let the divine presence in us. But there's also a different way, which is the extrovert, which the meaning is that you actually enhance bodily expressions and the body presence in the spiritual moment. So there's two ways. I mean, Hasidut, we can say the Magid of Meserich is the introvert style, and Reb Nachman of Breslov, which is a son of the Baal Shem Tov, actually they took another style, which is the extrovert. And I think has to do with his attitude to the body. That is also very present in his writing.
What is his attitude to the body? You began to speak about him integrating the body into the service, but how would you describe his attitude?
I would describe it, it's a well-known expression in Hasidut, avoda begashmiut, worshipping God with the material elements. If you smoke a cigarette, and his grandfather, Baal Shem Tov, has this kind of Ukraine pipes, which he saw, you know, the rings of the smoke is something that can uplift him. But actually he enjoyed the smoke, not to speak to today, but those days. Yes. So it's a kind of worshiping God for them. Or if you eat something and you enjoy the food or you enjoy the aesthetic of something, it's part of it. Don't cut, you know, don't deny your own bodily existence and sides of life from the spiritual experience. Mm. But rather try to actually inside it, you know, Nachmanides was the first one to say, you know, you go to the market and you put in a plastic bag tomatoes and you can speak with people, very simple people, about all these technical things, how much does it cost and blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, your mind can be up. So this kind of trying to include these two elements of this concrete life, joy, bodily existence of us and of the world, and at the same time to see the divine in it. Mm. This kind of... also, for example, Reb Nachman is saying there's all kinds of faith. By the way, it's interesting to say that there's all kinds of stages of faith, not that... As I said in the beginning, you decided that you believe in God, okay, V, and that's it. But there's stages in faith. For example, you said somebody can have a faith in his brain. But the most important thing is that he will have faith in all his limbs. This is, I'm quoting, translating from Hebrew. So you need to have a faith also in your hands. If you're clapping hands, with the joy, so the divine presence now also in your hands. And if you are dancing, which was a very prominent thing in the ritual of the Hasidic community, so God now is in your heels, and you can uplift your heel. He will be upper. So try to, I would say that, you know, the most important thing is to live the divine in all its essence in a high extensive way. Mm. Not to be, you know, doing what you need to do or think that you need to do because you are supposed to do it, but rather with the joy and intensity. Mm. Empowering also the emotion. You know, for the Hasidic writing is about love and fear from God. You know, you have to do every mitzvah, every commandment, every ritual that you do with love and fear. Mm. Otherwise, won't uplift. It's a new idea. Like, you know, in the Talmud, they won't say you have to do it with this and this. You should have to do it. You just have to do it. But to say you have to do it with love and fear and with joy and sometimes with cleaving, which is a dvikut, intensity, is a kind of a chidush of intensifying.
An innovation.
In innovation, it's intensifying the religious life. And I think this is the new aspect of Hasidut, understanding that you should intensify your work with God. And for Nachman historical understanding, it won't work if you do what you have to do just because it was written to you in the religious context, but you should intensify it. You should feel it in you. You should give it a place in all your existence sides.
So what I'm hearing from you is that Rabbi Nachman is really a radical mystic in some sense. He's fighting against the status quo, against the bourgeoisie Jew who is fulfilling all of their obligations according to the letter of the law, the Shulchan Aruch, and therefore feels that they're doing their job. And he wants them, as you said, to be like wild animals yelling out to God in the middle of the night. I have both like an embodied, right? Rabbi Nachman asks us to be embodied. And I have an embodied response and question, and then I have a bit more of a theoretical question. The embodied response is that I feel pretty bourgeoisie sitting here with my cup of tea, and we're sitting in these very plush couches on the beautiful Shalom Hartman campus. And I feel like a bit of a hypocrite talking about being breaking the status quo, being an animal screaming in the night. So I'm curious if that cognitive dissonance sits with you at all, and how you reconcile the scholar and the demand of Reb Nachman. And maybe we'll start with that question.
Wow. I think hypocrisy was one of the Hasidic understanding. There's a very beautiful story that I like, talking about one of the Admorim, the rabbis of the Hasidut, and he's saying that he was sitting in his room and he was hearing, you know, people came to see the rabbi to ask his advice and to ask. So he's sitting in his room and he hears behind the door, people are scratching the door, and he's thinking to myself, oh, I'm so important. So many people came to see me. Wow. And then he opens the door and see the cat, actually. So this kind of story is a fantastic story, actually, to say that Hasidism actually was about trying to be very honest with yourself, you know, try not to fool yourself with all the things that we are falling into. Trying to get money, respect, acknowledgement, whatever, you know, and to be very careful, attuned, and listening carefully to your inner motivation. I think this is something very important about Hasidism, the inner motivation to be aware and to speak about it, you know. Ga'ava, the pride that we all looking, you know, just be very attuned. Maybe you think you are humble, but thinking about yourself as a humble might be part of your pride. And this kind of thinking about, so you're asking about myself. Yes, I'm a little bit bourgeois. It's true. I'm not living in a tent. But I think that I'm trying in my life not to be conformist in its lower stage, and to challenge myself in my inclination into bourgeois life. I think it has to do something with if you adapt this kind of life, not to feel very comfortable with where you are. I'm not saying that I'm very successful in that, but I think it needs to be. It needs to be in your life that you have to challenge yourself and your comfortable zones and your inner motivations. This is the psychoanalysis side of me that I'm very attached to Hasidut because of this. Where are we in our inner life, you know? And it also resonates the divine for the Hasidim, because there's also inner life of God. There's not just the external action of God described in the Bible, but there's, for the Kabbalist and mystical tradition, there's the inner side of God. Hasidic writing came with a beautiful expression of kadmut ha-sechel, which can be, you know, the unconscious, we might translate it, something that actually drives you, but you're not aware to it. And, you know, it's a many, many years before Freud. Mm. So it's very interesting, this kind of dealing with the inner motivation in a very profound way that I don't know before that in the Jewish tradition.
It is. It's fascinating to explore this tension between approaching these texts as a scholar, where we strive for some sort of, you know, critical eye and objectivity as far as we can, but then also feeling genuinely challenged. And it seems to me that both you and many of your colleagues here are in that very rich space between scholarship and between a real commitment, an existential commitment. And it's not just an intellectual hobby. It's not just trivia. It's not just trying to figure out which manuscript was read by which philosopher.
You're also interested in that. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I think it's, there's a very beautiful mix here where the sometimes, and you know this perhaps better than many, the way that Rabbi Nachman or any other spiritual character from history who demanded real degrees of honesty and authenticity and self-questioning, they're taken up in some very loose, new age, hippie, easy forms of spirituality that aren't critical and aren't demanding and don't question ourselves and don't question our lifestyles. And I'm wondering if the sort of the critical eye of the scholar you feel may be actually beneficial in your own spiritual engagement with those texts.
Yes, I think that, you know, my own, I would say, infrastructure of my of my myself is a kind of a critical too. And I think it won't be enough for me to look in a very simplistic way on this text. And I think what you actually describe, people taking it to many, many shallow, I would say, places, has to do a lot with what Rabbi Nachman is saying himself about being uncritical and telling, don't read, you know, philosophy. But I think maybe he's right. Maybe we shouldn't read religion in a philosophical eyes. Maybe it's something has to do more with the different dimensions. And maybe it fools us if we take philosophy as the only tool to examine religious experiences. Mm. So I think he's aware of that. Let me tell you about something that I love about Rabbi Nachman, also challenging me.
You're saying that his own anti-philosophical bend may lead to some of the way that he's
keeping
himself.
Yeah, it does. Actually, I have to admit, it does in what we see around. Rabbi Nachman has a very, I love this kind of story about his life. He's actually saying that Rabbi Nathan, his disciple and the one who actually put his master on text, publishing his writing. Rabbi Nathan saying that Rav Nachman was dealing with one of the biggest question in philosophy ever. I mean, in all the religion, you know, philosophy in all religion, the question about God's omniscience, and from the one side, and the free will of the human being.
Right.
And
this classic theological quandary, God knows everything, how do we have free choice?
Yeah, how do we have a choice if everything he knows, and do we have a free choice? And this is a big question that actually, you know, it's in all the three monotheistic questions, you can find it, and people are thinking about it. And Maimonides wrote, and he wrote something that God knows not the way we know, that therefore it can happen. And Ravid there, one of the disciples saying, it's not good that Maimonides opened this question because it's a tricky one, might can fall on this question. So Rabbi Nachman knows all of this because he himself reads a lot of Maimonides.
He's not unaware, right? Although he's telling his reader not to read it.
And he's saying the following story. He said, Rabbi Nachman had an answer to this kind of a question, and he wrote it on a piece of paper. He wrote a note with the answer to this question, but he lost the piece of note. This is a story that he tells. And he says, it's good that he lost the note. And Rav Nachman is actually saying that forgetting things is very good. People usually think that forgetting things is not a good thing. Of course, to remember and to know, this is the ideal. But Rav Nachman thinks that to forget things, it's very good. And now we come up with the idea that actually we spoke about in many angles in this discussion with you, in this conversation, that you need to create yourself. It's an ongoing process. He had an answer to that certain day, 1779, you know, in I don't know where, let's say Narvish or Uman. He had this kind of answer to himself. He forgot it, but now he needs to create a new answer. I think it's very interesting because we know also psychological research shows us that every stage in life, people are thinking about God in a different way. It's not the way that a 4 years old and a 15 years old and a 30 years old think about God in different ways. And therefore, you need to create something. So an answer, you will give an answer, you know, Maimonides gave an answer. How does it resonate in me? I need to create my own answer to that. And the chidush that I will come up, the answer, my own innovation will create the next stage that I will need to stand on for next day. So I thought it was, you know, wow, eye-opening to say, you know, in a tradition that, you know, based itself on learning and remembering, to say it's good that sometimes to forget. And in another time, Rav Nachman says, you know, sleeping is a great thing.
You'll have to forgive me. I asked too many personal questions. But I love this last idea that you brought up, that the answer is never enough. And if we have the answer, we're actually static and we're stale. We're stuck. And in some sense, the question is more rich than the answer, because questions always demand more. And we need new answers in every day, in every generation. And from what I hear, it's Rabbi Nachman giving, he gave his answer and throughout his lifetime gave many answers. it's a really beautiful idea. It reminds me of a story told of a character sometimes compared with Rabbi Nachman, which is Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Kotzk, the Kotzk Rebbe, who was also notorious in his quest for truth, following the Talmudic adage that the seal of God is truth. And they say that he didn't write anything down himself, like many great religious characters and geniuses. But he kept sort of one little notepad, one paper, and he kept sort of refining that one paper and coming to like one truth proposition that he could come to and crossing it out and rewriting it.
Is it that what we do in our life, trying to go back to the same sentence and to refine it again and again?
They call it the palimpsest, this piece of paper that's been erased 1,000 times, right? That we do it. And they say in the end that he instructed his disciples to bury him with the paper, because even that truth that he refined over years and years and years of deep in soul searching was only the truth for him for that moment. And he didn't want it to become a gospel for, you know, to be the truth, the answer for the future. So on this theme of questions, allow me to ask a personal question, which is that you're speaking of your own engagement with Rabbi Nachman and with Jewish texts and ideas and thinkers more broadly speaking, and you have a very rich engagement in that, and it's a beautiful thing to encounter. Is there one question that has been bothering you or irking you through the years, the skeptic, the critic inside of Bitty's mind? Is there one question that's
well,
undermining
there
you?
There are many. You know, I would say that as a third generation to Holocaust survivor from Auschwitz, my grandfather, this is a question that bothered me. Evil in life, yeah. So I don't see life as, you know, how do you say, a kaspomat, that's something you put to take ATM. Money, ATM kind of machine, that God has to do what you want. I'm not looking at my relationship to God like this. But, and I do to myself, thinking about God as somebody who do gives us a free will. Otherwise it won't be meaningful to be here, and that he actually stepped back and we can create evil world or the best world. Nevertheless, it bothers me. Mm. It bothers me. Do a father that see two sons fighting each other, should not separate them from doing so. So I'm with this question, and I think it's a challenging. I would say that on one side is Job. This is the question of Job. On the other side, Kohelet, as you say, Ecclesiastes. he is also bothered by a very big question about the meaningful. Is there meaningful to this world? Is there meaning? Or maybe everything is for vain. So it's also a question that goes with me. And, you know, Rabbi Nachman is described as somebody that once his old disciples came to him. You know, people came, it wasn't an airplane and not a bus and not a taxi. They came up leaving their, you know, their career, I would say. Yes, their parnasa, their family, coming to see him. Mm. And he said, I don't know. Why did you come to me? Mm. I have nothing to tell you. Mm. There's nothing that I know. Mm. And Rav Natan, his disciple, says from this situation of him saying, I don't know, came a big Torah, a big chidush, a big
insight.
A big insight. So it's a little bit to know that, like Socrates is saying, you know, the wise knows that he doesn't know. You need to Lishot, you need to presence in this kind of situation, and it's a part of the journey of life. Mm. And it's striking that, you know, a rabbi, a master that's supposed to lead his disciples to know everything, he is saying to them, actually educating them. I don't know.
Mm. It's a very fascinating model, and I think about our current spiritual leadership in various traditions, our own rabbinic leadership, and how much of it is these faces of assurance and authority and knowledge and absolute answers versus someone like Rabbi Nachman who says, I don't know, it's a really radical model to exemplify. Can you tell us about Rabbi Nachman, the storyteller, and how those themes are making his way into his really incredible, elaborate stories, and why they're so like shocking and revolutionary in his religious literary context?
Right. So first of all, I would say it's an innovation style or genre in the Hasidic writing, because usually stories that been told in this area was about admiring the tzaddik, admiring the master. He was that from very early stage. He could read everything and he could remember everything, and he was so full of good deeds and everything.
These hagiographies of saints.
Hagiographies. Yeah. This is what we find a lot in the Hasidic writing. But here comes Rabbi Nachman. First of all, as I said, he writes about himself as a anti-hero. Mm. But to leave this aside, he is developing a kind of poetic writing, which will be like science fiction, fantasy, that actually he tells that, and he admits that he takes from all over. A European style of storytelling, and it's a conglomerate. He's putting it inside. He makes it a kind of a text that needs to do something. 4 years before he died, he died in a very early stage. He was 38. You know, like Luzzatto and Luria, they all came not to the age of 40. So 4 years before he died, he said, it's not enough what I have been telling you all these years. Nothing is really happening. Your heart is still a stone. Mm.
He wasn't affecting the change he was hoping to see.
Yeah, but maybe he wanted to tease them, or maybe he was really frustrated with them. Nevertheless, he says, sometimes he says, you're a feather, like in my collar. Maybe they came to admire him, and he said, okay, move around. But he says, 4 years before this, let me tell you now stories. And as I said, from stories, you might awake somebody that is sleeping in a very deep sleep. He's understanding that the style of art, poetic, might be much more meaningful and awakening than homilies is very interesting. And has also to understand his insight about psyche, the psyche of the believer. To say, sometimes if you say something very direct, you give a verse from the Bible, you bring a text from the Talmud, people are closing their minds. It's they know that somebody now is coming to give them tochecha, to give them to tell them something that they're not good,
rebuke
them. But if you tell them a story about a princess, a beautiful princess, and, you know, and a king, and a snake, and a mountain of jewelry, so, wow, everyone is fascinating. We all love stories. We get into the stories. Most of the stories of Rav Nachman are not ended. It's not they lived happily ever after. It's, he cuts it in the end. So the reader, or the, I must say, the listener is going with the story, trying to make sense of the story, makes him to be immersed in the experience of the story, and to question it and to think about it. So let's take the, you know, the first very famous legend of Rav Nachman about the little princess. She's a sister of six brothers, and the king loves her most, and he plays with her and amuse together, and they have great fun. And I don't know what happened. Maybe she stepped on her feet, or he says a curse, and she's going to her room crying. And the day after, they didn't find her. And then starts a story of a few pages, let's say about 20 pages, about the way this king is trying to find his daughter. And it goes all ways around. At the end, it says he did find her, but the way he actually released her, she was locked on a castle. He didn't say. So this is a story that I just said. In a, you can summarize it in three sentences, but the story is a very long story, and you get into it and you ask yourself, who is the little princess? Is this me? Is this the soul? Is this the anima? Is this the people of Israel? Is this a Shekhinah, the divine woman in the Kabbalah? And it works on you. It's like it, you think about it, and is this the lost soul that I have to get myself back to the king, which is the Lord, which is God? Is so in this way, he wanted to create a kind of temptation to his disciples to go inside their inner, you know, motivation, life, a feeling of their lost, of their alienation from God, of their far, being far away from God, and to create a kind of a move to motivate them to move, to bring back the little princess back to her origin, or God, or her lover, or her father, whatever you would say. So I think this kind of understanding poetic, we can see it also in his writing, which is full with associations, a associative way of thinking and poetry style. He's a genius in that.
So there's something powerful about the story you're saying, where firstly it catches us off guard, right? Where we know when we're about to get a lecture and we shut our ears off.
Exactly.
And the story we has the capacity to slip beneath our guard doors.
I think we can see it, you know, all over. I think the whole world of advertisement is on this, on the images.
Right.
On,
yeah. Right. these unconscious associations. And then there's also the capacity where in the story we can begin to identify with the character, and we can feel like we're part of the story. We can feel like we're concerned with the outcome. And he leaves the endings, you're saying, exactly, sort of cut off, broken, ambiguous. And there's a sense perhaps of an incompleteness that we ourselves have to partake in completing, which is no different really. Rabbi Nachman is perhaps the first Hasidic author to use these epic stories in his way of trying to wake up the people from their spiritual slumber. But in reality, the Bible, right, is also a book of stories that in some ways are conveying these truths that we're unpacking for thousands of years to come. So there is something organic. And the Midrashim, I mean, there is a long tradition.
Also in the Zohar, there's a lot of stories. But the tune is different. Mm. The tune of the Bible and the Talmud and some of the stories that we know is a very educating.
Mm.
It's a musar. It gives you, no, you're not good enough. You sinned. And these kind of stories are different. They sit on the images. As Rabbi Nachman says, it's a sipurim mishanim kadmoniyot. He says it's a stories from the primordial times, you know. It's like an archetype, Jungian archetype. It's the soul, it's the anima, it's the old person, it's the baby. It's like, and you get yourself into this kind of a very, very deep and profound way of thinking about yourself in all these kind of images and in the describing a kind of masaf of a voyage, you know, that you have to take in life. It's, and you understand that it actually works on a very deep level.
Mm. Who might you compare Rabbi Nachman to in this aspect of his storytelling style and his authorship? Who does anyone come to mind?
He's unique. I know there's a story that actually we can base historically.
Hmm.
That while Buber came to Europe to speak about Rabbi Nachman, Kafka, or one of his friends, sat there in Buber's telling about Rabbi Nachman's stories. So, for example, a story about, how do you say, Lifnei Achok, before the law, which talks about a person that sits the whole day wanting to get into a castle or to meet somebody. Nevertheless, you're not, it's not clear why he's not doing it, but he's not doing it. Mm. And at the end of the day, the guide of the place said, it was for you.
Mm.
Like, we waited for you.
Mm.
So this kind of story we can see in some of the stories that Rabbi Nachman told. Rabbi Nachman wrote tons of stories, something like 100 stories.
Wow.
Were collected lately by Tzvi Marco. But this kind of story we can find in many of the stories of Rabbi Nachman about somebody that needs to do something and he's not doing it, and actually he missed it, but it was for him.
Mm.
You know, this kind of understanding. So I think maybe Kafka, very different, but maybe Kafka, but he's unique.
Was Kafka reading Rabbi Nachman? Is there any possibility of that?
The only fact that we know that Kafka or his friends were exposed to the lectures that Martin Buber gave in Europe, that he might, you know, be inspired by it.
Mm.
Yes, but he is unique. Mm. He is unique, and some of the the Hebrew new poets and writers in Israel describe him as the first one. One say he was lunatic and he was crazy, and you know, this kind of people that came from the Enlightenment and rational side of Jewish, that couldn't bear this kind of treating Jewish life in a kind of a fantasy for kids or with dreams.
Mm.
But Sam actually appreciated that there's a kind of a treasure in his poetic writing.
Mm. I want to just draw. I don't want to keep you for too much longer. You've been very generous with your time. We throw our watches away when we sit down, so we don't know what time it is. But
what time is it?
I have no idea. We've only really touched on one swath of your research and your scholarship and your immense knowledge, and we're very grateful for you sharing it with us, and for the time that you put in, the hours and hours that you put in going through these texts and sitting with them and exploring them and questioning them, it's a real gift that you did that, and now we're able to be yonek, we're able to suckle on some of that wisdom. There are many other sides of your scholarship. We didn't mention, you know, the Kabbalists of Tzfat, the 16th century renaissance of Jewish mysticism, but another area which you're quite well known for is your work on the Zohar, and specifically on the Tikkuni Zohar, the last strata, the latest strata of the Zohar. Maybe just as a final segue to whet the listener's appetite for perhaps another round, or to dig into your own published scholarship, what was the relationship between Rabbi Nachman and the Tikkuni Zohar? How did those themes that are in there, some themes of the divine feminine, other themes that you explore, how did they make their way to connect your two loves here, if we can put it that way?
Definitely. Actually, historically speaking, and biography speaking, I started with Rabbi Nachman, and I said, there's a lot of Kabbalistical ideas here. I need to go back. And then I went to study Zohar, and I was very impressed and inspired by this kind of latest strata of the Zohar, which is in 14th century, probably, again, in the Iberian place, Spain, Tikkuni Zohar, which actually is an unbelievable writing. Actually, the book, the main book of this kind of books, called Tikkuni Zohar, the frame of the book is to give 70 homilies to the word, the only word, and the first word in the Bible, Bereshit, to say that every word in the Bible needs to get this kind of treatment. By the way, Ramchal, Rabbi Chaim Lutzato, takes this kind of, take this idea and does it for the last words of the Bible. But there's a very profound idea here of the Jewish tradition, that the Jewish tradition is not about dogma, but rather about exeges and giving commentaries and seeing, and you know, the idea of deconstruction, deconstructia of the letters and the language is embodied here, not just in the 20th century, but here, to say that every word can be separated and every word is a kind of an infinite ideas that you can put into it. I think it's very crucial to understand the Jewish tradition. Nevertheless, this Kabbalist that we don't know, he's anonymous, we don't know his name, is coming up with a kind of, I would say, you know, of a stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
He starts with one word and he's way, blah, blah, blah. He's going up with his ideas, interweaving them idea to idea to idea. It can start with a word in the Bible, go to a kind of a midrash, making a numerical understanding, putting the word into two pieces. This for me was a kind of, first it was a riddle to understand what he's saying, because it was for me, like you say, Greek, nachon, say, what is it doing here? So it was very inspiring. And second of all, to understand the way he thinks and to understand his kind of creativity blow my mind. Then I said to myself, what's his idea? Because as I told you, I'm a daughter of a psychoanalyst. And the scholars of the Kabbalah, Gershom Shalom and Yeshayahu Tishbi, said this Kabbalist is wandering from idea to idea. He's not systematical. He's just going with wherever he wants. To my understanding, psychologically, this cannot be the truth. If you have a stream of thought, you have an idea that you want to say or something that leads you. So then I went to try to discover what his interest, what his real interest is.
What's his thesis?
What is all these ideas are coming on? What he wants to say? And I came up with the idea that he's very interested in the divine feminine aspect, which we call it in the Kabbalah, the Shekhinah, which is a very womanly God, which it was very striking to see. That he actually say, let's worship her. Like God, he is the Father, he brings the law, he is the transcendent, he is the perfect, and she actually carries all the defects of this world, of the divine, if one might say it. For example, she describes as somebody that cannot walk.
She the Shekhinah, this goddess.
She the Shekhinah. And based on the Amos, you know, verses about the Shekhinah, that she's falling to the dust and she cannot stand up. And she's going with the people of Israel to the exile. She is the lover of God, but nevertheless, she is with the people of Israel. So I wrote an article that people actually said, wow, 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 what is it? You know, the divine cripplenessy, how can I say it, you know? And it's very interesting that the woman, the feminine, actually carries all the imperfect of God. And she's actually identified with the history itself, which has ups and downs, and the Jews had a lot of downs. And she's described as the secret of the possible. Like he is, you know, he is the perfect and what needs to be. The actual one, not just the actual, but the mechuyav ha-metziut. This is what needs to be. But she actually carries all the possibility of the divine, which was a striking idea to understand that this kind of Kabbalist doesn't describe God just as perfect, you know, in a philosophical way, that if he wants something, it's an obstacle, it's a defect, but rather that he's involved in history. Sometimes they call the Shekhinah in the word, she is involved in the history, and they call her Ani's eye. So she is the...
Why are they calling her I?
Because
it's the identification.
She's here. She's present. She's first present. He is the who. He is the there.
The transcendent. The distant.
He's the third person, you say in English, right? But she is here.
That's the etymology of Shekhinah is the Shochen.
She's here. She dwells here. She's with us. And their sensibility, I mean, their ability to describe feminine Bechlali in the Kabbalah, in the Zohar, and the aspects of the feminine, the daughter and the mother and the mother and the lover and, you know, the womb and giving birth. That my friend Ruth Kara wrote a whole book about it and about the maternity and about feeding and all these kind of aspect and functions are striking. Some people thought this is might be maybe this the thesis that somebody, a woman wrote the Zohar. I don't think it's true, but nevertheless, it's striking the ability to be so sensible and to describe the feminine, to understand how giving birth and how being in love is all crucial to this world and to describe the divine as this. So, this was one of my... discovery about this book and other also. And also I found a description of her putting on tefillin, you know, which considered to be a very masculine ritual, describing her as the hevel, you know. The hevel is the breath that comes from your mouth, the fluidity of the divine, the possibilities of the divine, the history, the downside, the defects, all this very striking in
this
book. And this book had a very tremendous influence on the Jewish mysticism later on. It was published before the Zohar even, and in many, many, you know, editions, and it influenced, you know, Hasidut, and it influenced Rabbi Nachman, also the ideas and also the style of writing, associative and this kind of very tense and dense writing. And the Gaon of Vilna wrote a commentary to it, and Ramchal, as I mentioned, and, you know, Rav Kook, and it was all very, very, I mean, scholarly, it was abandoned a little bit to the Zohar. It's not a systematic, it's not a, you know, the Zohar has its own theology, there's a story, and this kind of was too dense, but actually it reminds a lot from the Hasidic writing, which is a very, you know, short idea, and you go with a associative way of thinking, and it's striking to see the influential aspect of this.
So you're saying while it was ignored,
scholarly, a little bit.
While it was a little bit neglected in scholarly analysis.
In the beginning of the scholarly Zoharic
undertaking field. That project. But for the Hasidic world, it was very influential. I know myself reading Chabad Hasidut, it's quoted all the time, probably more than other strata of the Zohar.
For example, the idea that you probably saw it in Chabad, let atar panoy minei, there's no void place from God. It's not a Zoharic, it's from Tikkuni Zohar. Tikkuni Zohar has this kind of emanation, meaning the divine described as something that comes from a stage to a stage, gradually to this place.
Right.
But Tikkuni Zohar has this kind of different theology, which is immanent. God presents new. If you know Patach Eliyahu, it's a very well-known text from Tikkuni Zohar. Another aspect of Tikkuni Zohar, so influential.
Right.
This text went into the liturgic.
Right.
Patach Eliyahu.
Right.
Describe God as a water that watering the tree, the tree of life in the world, which is more immanent. God is here, God presence here, and he's within, even within you.
Or she.
So this kind of, for example, this idea is the Tikkuni Zohar. Or to say, you know, Tchilu Rimu, which is also kind of became a kind of a phrase for liturgy. I'm doing this this act in the sake of unifying God, the masculine and the divine, with Tchilu Rimu, with love and fear, is a Tikkuni Zohar expression to say, again, you need to do things with fear and love. It's not enough to do it. And as Tikkuni Zohar saying, it's like a bird that cannot uplift to the air if one of the wings is missing. Is a Tikkuni Zohar. To speak about the tefillah in this kind of hierarchy, even more than studying Torah, is also Tikkuni Zohar. Speaking about revelation and Hidgalut is very common in Tikkuni Zohar. So there's a lot of things that actually came from Tikkuni Zohar, and also scholars and traditional writing see the Zohar and Tikkuni Zohar together, but they are not.
That was a really brilliant survey of some of the key themes that are making their way from the Tikkuni Zohar into contemporary or modern, let's say, Hasidic theology and life. What are the perhaps particular themes that Rabbi Nachman specifically is picking up from? I'm sure he's employing all of these to some extent, but is there any really core central themes that he's connecting with and continuing and innovating on?
I need to think about it, but you know, it's common to say, and I believe in that, scholarly speaking, that the difference between Kabbalah, Middle Ages, Kabbalah, let's say the Zohar, and Hasidut in the 18th century is that Hasidut took Kabbalah and we call it psychologization of the Kabbalah. Or as Martin Buber said, making mysticism into ethos. One of the Chabad Admorim is describing it, taking the diamond of Kabbalah, grinding it
right.
into
powder
and feeding the mass.
Right.
So this kind of taking the very, you know, complicated idea and feeding the mass, which need to be something.
The masses.
That needs to be something very short and very clear and very, very close to one's way of living. Like we said before, there's no void of God or Tchilu Chimu, love and fear, all these kind of ideas found their way into this. I wrote an article about this, the story that we spoke about, The Lost Princess, and I actually show that Rav Nachman took it from a one piece from Tikkuni Zohar, writing about the mitzvah, the commandment of lost and found. that you need to actually inside Tikkuni Zohar, there's a section that speaks about the commandments, giving a mystical explanation to each commandment, which is fascinating. I love this kind of mystical writing about commandments and ritual because it looks so technique, and then you come up with a mystical ideas. It's like crazy. Yeah. So he speaks about. Tikkuni Zohar speaks about lost and found, this kind of commandment that you need to bring back if you found something that is not yours. And he gives a mystical explanation to it, like he does to all the commandments. And he says that the lost is the princess. And I could see that the text that actually inspired the Rav Nachman was this text that the lost is the princess. You need to bring it back to yourself and you need to bring it back to the king. And so... You know, Rav Nachman was very creative. He saw the Tikkuni Zohar. He says the Tikkuni Zohar is above the Zohar, and he spoke, admired the Tikkuni Zohar. And I could prove that, you know, this is a kind of a mystical explanation to this commandment, made him write it, change it into a poetic, you know.
It's a fascinating idea that the lost object is the soul, or is the lost divine, object, yeah. Feminine, that we have to return in some.
And then he comes up with an amazing idea that you go in Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah, you know, the beginning of the year, which is a day of awe and a day of confession and guilt. And, you know, you need to make a cheshbon nefesh and to think what happened in your life, blah, blah, blah. Actually change into this kind of idea that actually ones go every beginning of the year, and what he needs to think is what did he lost this year that he needs to bring back. And blowing the shofar, this is Rav Nachman, one of the Torot, one of the writing, that blowing the shofar is actually when you it's announcement that you found now what you lost. And he said also the master, also the tzaddik is losing, because it says in Kohelet, yes, there's a time to lose and there's a time to find. So actually life is a kind of a cycle of lost and found. So this kind of way of treating, you know, the ideas, it's very interesting, because what we saw that there is a myth sitting on the commentary of Tikkuni Zohar to speak about, you know, the princess is the Shekhinah, is the divine feminine, and it's the soul. Bringing it into a commandment homily, and then Rav Nachman brings it back to a kind of a mythical way, telling a story about it, taking all kinds of commandment clues, but giving us the pure story of it. So it's a kind of a nice, you know, round, going back and round. In what way can I persuade you to do some change in your life and to go and find something that you lost or deny or abandoned or didn't take care of enough?
I have the feeling like we could go on for many hours, and some people, the more that you talk with them, they sort of get tired and they kind of, their energy droops off. And with you, I feel it's just the opposite. I feel like your energy is just beginning to get. I feel like it also might rain on us soon, and I do want to be conscious of your time and let you go back home to your house and your family, whoever's waiting for you. But I would just like to say thank you so very much for sitting with us and for sharing with us so openly and so authentically. And it's hard to say because, you know, we can't read the mind of Rabbi Nachman, but I think Rabbi Nachman would be very proud with a conversation like this that's rigorous and thoughtful and challenging, and trying to bring his ideas to a wider audience. And I'd like to thank you both for your work throughout your career doing that work, and the small sliver of it now of sharing with us, with our audience here, with this collaboration with Shalom Hartman and Seekers of Unity.
Thank you, Zevik. It was a pleasure talking to you. It's so special. And it was a pleasure. And I thank you for this opportunity.
My pleasure. Wonderful. I really feel like we're just getting started.
It's true, you know, it's my style.